listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, where we are dedicated to awakening the world to the power and importance of human emotions. For nearly 40 years, I've been practicing in California as a transpersonal psychotherapist. To me, this has meant helping people to discover in what ways they're living their lives outside of ancient universal principle and help them to bring themselves back into alignment with those principles. Well, today we're looking at another perspective on how psychology and spirituality work, and most especially how they can work together. I'm talking with Dr. Itai Itzvan about how awareness is freedom. Please post your comments and questions on our blogs at emotionalpro.com and blogtalkradio.com/FPL. And those of you in the U.S. can also talk with us on the toll-free number, which is 888-498-0570. 888-498-0570. And remember, we also distribute through subscription on iTunes. Well, Dr. Itai Ibitsan is passionate about the combination of psychology and spirituality. He's a positive psychologist, a senior lecturer, and the program leader of MAP, which is the Masters in Applied Positive Psychology at the University of East London in England. You can find out more about him at awarenessisfreedom.com. So, Dr. Itai Ibitsan, welcome to Full Power Living.
Hello, Eileen. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, when I began as a psychotherapist in 1972 in California, people who were affiliated with psychotherapy or psychology didn't dare whisper anything about spirituality related to their work. And now here you are writing a book about how to marry them together. So I want to start out by asking you, what makes you think these two need to be married together?
Well, I think in line with the same comment you've made, when I just started about 20 years ago, and I used to say to people, I'm really fascinated by spirituality, and more than that, I love the topic of mindfulness and meditation. It feels so meaningful to me. People used to look back and they used to say something like, you know, this is all very interesting, but, you know, if you want to have a career at the academia, maybe you want to change a topic. And now, 20 years down the line, I feel that so much has changed, and you know, people don't have that kind of reaction anymore. Spirituality is much more accepted within the boundaries of psychology today, especially if we consider meditation, which I think is a very important dimension of spirituality. So I think a lot has changed since you started, since I started, when it comes to you know, what interests people and what we find meaningful. Now, going back to your question, why is it that I think we should marry them? I believe that in order for us to have a full human experience, one where we truly, fully experienced our human potential, we need to be able to address both of these worlds. And the way I think about it in my head, I have this image of striking roots into the ground, which is the psychological aspect, and then having these wonderful opening aspects into the sky, and that's spirituality. And that allows us a very healthy balance. And I think that each of them, psychology and spirituality, offer us a different aspect of our human development. And only when we bring them together, we get this experience of living life fully.
Well, I can only agree with you. And having used these kinds of concepts for about 40 years and helping people to grow, my own experience is that people grow ever so much faster and more completely when they're married. Yeah.
Why is it that this marriage is so essential to our well-being, to our self-awareness, to our growth? The way I think about it, psychology is this incredible science of deciphering who and what we are. So, you know, imagine that we are this mosaic and maybe a puzzle or this image made out of different bits and pieces. And psychology allows us to, as if we turn on a spotlight and we become aware through the psychological process of that which we perceive as ourself. So if I see myself as carrying certain attributes and I have certain expectations of myself and I have certain understandings of what am I and what am I not and what's important to me and what is less meaningful and so on and so forth, psychology is this wonderful world where I become aware of all that and I could examine all of them. And then we have spirituality, which for me, and it's really important to say that spirituality in the scientific world has been defined in so many different ways, and we can approach it in very different ways. So it's not as if there's this one way of understanding spirituality. I think the beauty of spirituality is that it's extremely subjective, and it's a very personal journey that each of us go through, a spiritual journey. But I believe that at the heart of almost everyone's journey is that experience of self-transcendence, which is the experience of moving beyond the self and connecting with life and everything around us in a way that isn't limited to the personal self, in a way that goes beyond that self. Now, I believe that it is very, very difficult for us to transcend that which we don't know. I'll say it again because I think it's very, very important to understand. If we are not aware of that self that I talked about earlier in the context of psychology, it's very difficult to transcend it. From a psychological point of view, for example, if we talk about Jung, he talked about the shadow. So these are aspects of the self that I push aside, I'm not aware of, and if it is pushed aside, and if it is within that internal Pandora box, and I'm not aware of these aspects of myself, then it's very difficult for me to let go of it, or to transcend it, or to move beyond it. Therefore, and here comes the important point, I really need the psychological process of self-exploration and self-knowledge in order for me to move into self-transcendence. So they are in many ways holding hands, psychology and spirituality, in that beautiful transformative process of acknowledging all that I am and moving beyond it.
That's a lovely way of explaining it. I'm realizing that just yesterday I was having a conversation with my 7-year-old granddaughter, Ava, and we were talking about just that. We were talking about how I asked her if the body she's in and the person she knows her to be, if that was all there is to her. And she said yes, and I told her that I thought there was more, that there was more for everybody. And my own perception is that this earth is a big giant school and we've come here to learn and grow. And the best way I could explain what else there was to her was to start talking about energy, that there's like an energy part of ourselves. Is that what you're talking about with spirituality?
If I would have been asked to describe that experience, I don't think I would use the word energy because it feels a little bit unclear to me. And I would ask a person, and this is where, I mean, there's a clear distinction between children and adults. Personally, I feel that children are naturally in that space very frequently. They are not yet aware of the fact that they are experiencing it because it feels so natural to them. And I think as years go by, we lose it. The more we accumulate a sense of a self, the less we feel it naturally. But I think if I would have spoken to an adult who would have asked me a similar question, I would have asked them whether they've ever experienced a moment when they were standing perhaps at the top of a mountain and the sun was setting, and they felt that time disappears, and they're connected to their heart in a way that feels as if the whole world is within their hearts. And they feel this incredible love and compassion and deep, deep, deep acceptance, where they realize on an experiential level that truly nothing matters and everything is precisely as it is supposed to be. I would ask them if they've ever experienced that. And even if they would have said no, I would have asked them, how do they feel, for example, at the few seconds when they experience an orgasm? So I would just invite them to connect with these moments in life when we are in that state of transcendence, when we are at that state where the mind is in that frozen, as if we press the pause button to the mind, and we get this incredible connection with everything. And I would then talk about the experience of that as what I refer to as that self-transcendence and spirituality. Now, if you notice, what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to talk about the experience of it and not about who and what we are there. Because the truth is that I don't know. And yes, I agree with you, by the way, that this is indeed this kind of incredible playground we all came to in order to learn and grow. But for me personally, what matters is that people would be able to acknowledge that transcendent space so that they would be able to walk the path where they are moving deeper into the relationship with it and the acknowledgement of it.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a little bit of where I was trying to get with my granddaughter, just to introduce the concept a little bit. We didn't go much further than what I've shared with you. Just that there's a space where things are different. And, you know, her at age 7, her thinking mind has kicked in. So she's interested in playing around with things. A few months ago, I was.
Go ahead.
A few months ago, I talked with her about how I have enjoyed dividing people into pioneers and settlers, and she was able to identify that her mother is a settler and her father's a pioneer, and how that can create difficulties.
Nice. That's a beautiful distinction. Yeah, I think it's very nice with children. I completely agree with you that around the age 6 or 7, the thinking mind kicks in and the identity becomes much stronger. And if you look at children at an earlier age, especially when they've formed enough of an identity around the age of 2 or 3, but you're not yet strong enough to become an obstacle to that transcendent space, you see so much of that very deep presence and that incredible connection to the moment, and all of these concepts we talk about as part of spirituality, and they leave that kind of these kind of ideas as a very natural part of their lives. I mean, if you see, for example, the way they let go of the formal moment, to me it's such a wonderful teaching. Seeing how a child can go through a certain experience, maybe with another child, maybe even fighting over a toy. And then a moment later, they can sit together and play as if they are best friends, and nothing happened the moment before. And I love seeing that because for me it signifies that wonderful, the art of letting go, the art of accumulating no baggage, emotional baggage, the baggage of frustration and anger over what happened. It's just gone. It was in the former moment. Right now, in the following moment, it's irrelevant. It's not there anymore. So it's just a wonderful example to show how children are applying that, obviously unconsciously, beautifully.
Yes, and this age, you know, like you're saying, the child is developing a concept of the self, and that's part of what you talk about in Awareness mm-hmm. is Freedom, is the self and how our self-concept. So in childhood, we have like the possibility of a dual thing, not usually, but we're coming into the earth and we need to take on a level of self concept of, you know, self-esteem and so forth. And yet that's, according to you, those concepts that we set up, those are the very things that can later on get in our way.
That's precisely so. I think this is a wonderful journey that we choose to be part of. When we come here, as you say, we do choose to create that kind of sense of self, and I think it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. That experience of a self is an inevitable part of being human, and I think also it's a beautiful part of being human. I love my sense of self. I think that as we go deeper into the spiritual journey and as we move deeper into the awareness of that self, we have the ability to let go of that self at certain moments when it's appropriate. We also have the ability not to take that self too seriously. We have the ability to realize that this self is this fluctuating, moving, open, very flexible entity within us, and not something that defines us in a way that is like a rock that is unchangeable and unmovable. And when we approach the self in that way, then we can let go of it at certain moments. You know, I'll give you an example. The way I approach the whole topic, for example, of thinking, right? So I think that we came here to this world and we need to engage with life. So we need to make choices, and we need to compare options, and we need to make decisions, and it's all very, very important, and it's all part of being human. So we need to learn the art of doing all that, and that all stems from the self and the understanding of the world. And yet there's another art that we need to learn, and it's the art of letting go of all of these thoughts and letting go of all of these decisions and letting go of all these comparisons, so that we could move into that state of transcendence that I was talking about. And life for me is like breathing. Inhale and exhale, thinking and letting go, processing in the mind and then surrendering and moving from one to the other, because we are both, because we are that psychological and spiritual creature. And I think that the most important lesson we could learn in order to enhance our psychological and spiritual journey is the lesson of applying both the psychological and the spiritual aspect of ourselves and knowing when to do which. Because I think that one of the greatest illnesses we experience these days as a result of this super fast-paced world is that we are within the psychological thinking, comparing, cognitive processing aspect so frequently that we lose the connection with the spiritual aspect. And we lose the beautiful relationship we could have had with that surrendering space, which could offer us so much peace and so much inner balance and so much acceptance of life. So recreating that balance for me is a wonderful aspect of one's well-being, and that's another example to the reason behind the fact that psychology and spirituality should live within us together.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And I was a single parent for 20 years and developed a type of parenting at the time. I called it conscious parenting, which helped children to keep in mind that there was more to them than just what was happening in their present moment, to at least get glimpses of it. And I'm aware that what you're doing with your book is calling people's attention, those people who didn't have the benefit of that kind of child rearing, to call their attention to the fact that they can open that back up again. And that's really wonderful. And I want to talk more about that when we come back from our break, okay?
Excellent, great.
All right, so my guest today is Itay Itzvan, and he has written a book called Awareness is Freedom, and we'll have more when we return here on Full Power Living. Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us. Four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have just a few announcements. First, I want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through understanding the importance, mastery, and power of human emotions. Since emotions are part of everything, it allows us to explore many frontiers of change and transcendence and transformation that are now occurring, and I really appreciate you coming along on this really exciting investigation. Please go to our homepage, emotionalpro.com, to get your own copy of my free list of the signals of 7 everyday emotions. They can help you immediately to move toward mastery over emotions that come up in your own life. And while you're there, sign up to be on our mailing list so we can send you our bi-weekly newsletter telling you about our programs. Next week, CNN's grief recovery specialist, Russell Friedman, returns to Full Power Living to talk about grief recovery for children. So be here at 9 a.m. Pacific time next Thursday, March 3rd, for that show. I'm talking today with Dr. Itai Itzvan, who is a positive psychologist, a senior lecturer, and the program leader of the Masters in Applied Positive Psychology at the University of East London. He's also the author of Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality. So before our break, Dr. Itzvan, I brought up this notion that we all come here and we, in a sense, forget who we really are, and that it appears to me that a big part of what you're doing with your book is not only letting people know that there's more to life than what we may have been living, but also to give them some tools to open up.
Absolutely. The heart of my work is research and teaching of meditation. So if we talk about tools and if we talk about self-awareness, I personally feel that meditation is this incredible invitation for us to become aware of ourselves, of the different aspects of the self, and also of the potential that is beyond the self. There are wonderful studies in psychology showing that when we meditate regularly, we move through three we can call it developmental stages. So we start with a stage that is called self-regulation. So when we start meditation, for most of us, it's mostly about gaining more control over the mind, gaining more control over emotions, because when we lack meditation, when we lack that invitation for the moment, then the mind is out of control, emotions are out of control, we feel out of balance, so we search for something that would allow us to create a little bit more stability, a little bit more control over those aspects of the self. So that's how the journey begins for a lot of people, self-regulation. And then as we self-regulate and as we become more in control of the mind and more in control of the emotions, we move into the second stage, which is fascinating, because that's the stage of self-knowledge. That's the stage where we start acknowledging and seeing aspects of the self that under normal circumstances we're not aware of. That's very interesting, because we spend time in meditation and we become more in control over our thoughts, which means that we can observe them in our minds more clearly. They're not sort of rushing as this powerful river that overwhelms us, and instead we can sit just outside the river and watch the water flows, and then we can start seeing the patterns of the mind, and then the same applies to our emotions, because as we know, we can talk more about that later, but I think there's what psychology research is showing is a very strong relationship between our thinking patterns and our emotional patterns. They go hand in hand. So as I watch the river flow, when it comes to my thoughts, I also watch the emotional reactions that are triggered within me. And as I do that, I move into that second stage of self-knowledge, because I'm starting to see these patterns that are repeating themselves within me, and I'm starting to see these aspects of the self that perhaps were under my radar, the radar of my awareness, the radar of my consciousness, so they were just happening on an unconscious level. I'm starting to see all those, and I'm starting to recognize that which I am. And this is a very difficult stage for a lot of people, and I think this is one of the main reasons that, out of my experience, people stop meditating. It's very interesting, because we usually approach meditation with the idea that meditation will make our lives better and make us feel better, and it does. And yet at the same time, it makes us see aspects of ourselves that perhaps aren't always comfortable to see, aspects of the self that perhaps have been hidden for years. That's the second stage of self-knowledge, and it's such a powerful stage, and it's such an important stage. And then the third and final stage of the practice of meditation is self-transcendence, right? So as we move deeper into self-knowledge, and we are able to sit still as we observe these different aspects of the self that we used to fight with and feel uncomfortable with, and we move into a state of acceptance towards those, then we have this wonderful invitation to transcend and experience that connection with all, and that deeper peace, and this incredible happiness that is flowing within. And that's why I talk about meditation as the main tool, as part of that wonderful psychological and spiritual journey. Now, it's really important to say, as part of that discussion, that when I talk about happiness or acceptance or peace as part of or love or compassion as part of that self-transcendent space, I'm not talking about the traditional kind of happiness or love or peace, because the traditional approach to these emotions is one that is conditioned. So if certain things happened in my life, then I feel happy. If he or she said something, then I feel this warm feeling of love towards them. So this is all conditional emotion, and it's a beautiful aspect of our psyche, of our psychological journey. And yet the spiritual experience of peace or love or happiness, they're completely independent of anything that happens around me, anything that happens in my reality. They are deep within me. And the way I think about it is that we all have this internal undercurrent. So it's an undercurrent that is flowing deep, deep within us. And it's inviting us 24/7, every breath. It's inviting us, come in, jump into the water, enjoy this incredible feeling of connection to everything around you and the love and acceptance of everything around you. And when we say yes to that invitation, when we say yes, we move into that self-transcendence, and we get this glimpse of the self that is not limited, the personal self, but the one that is part of all that is around us. So it's important to distinguish when we talk, because you emphasize the question of emotions and the impact they have in our lives. So I just wanted to distinguish the way we experience emotions on a psychological level and what happens on a spiritual level.
That's really great. You know, on the chat, we have someone who's posing, a situation. It sounds more like a report of something that may have happened in their life. But I'm wondering how you might apply what you've just talked about to this. What is said is, we lose the power to have faith after our faith has been broken in our interactions with those with whom we believed we shared ethics and later found out they didn't indeed believe in the ethics they espoused. How would you work with these concepts, with that kind of situation?
Well, I obviously don't know the exact details of this person's experience, but the feeling I get when you read the words is a feeling of betrayal,
feeling
of trauma, a feeling of going through something where perhaps a promise has been broken or something that has been promised wasn't fulfilled, and the very natural reaction is a reaction of feeling pain and feeling loss. And I think this is almost an inevitable part of life. I don't know, I personally don't know a single human being who didn't experience at some level this kind of pain, this kind of disappointment. It's a natural part of life, and I think this is where the invitation for meditation becomes so important, because normally when we experience trauma, when we experience loss, when we experience pain, when we experience betrayal, we are overwhelmed psychologically, cognitively, emotionally, by that which is triggered within us. And it doesn't really allow us to sit with those emotions and to process them and to realize the meaning of the experience and to perhaps have the skill. And I know it's not an easy thing to be able to do, but the skill of embracing that which is moving within us and accepting that sadness is a natural part of life. And when we are able to do that, when we are able to move from the rejection of what we call negative emotions into the embracing of negative emotions to a point where they don't throw us out of balance, we can sit still and allow the sadness to move through us. Have you seen by a chance? And I'm asking the listeners as well, if anyone has seen the movie Inside Out.
Yes, I have.
Inside Out is you have. And do you remember that the relationship that Joy had at the beginning with sadness, and how sadness was. Okay, so it's the different emotions are moving within that child,
right?
And Joy, the happy character, throughout most of the movie, is pushing sadness aside. It's the kind of go away, you know, don't touch anything, don't do. So that's the normal reaction most of us have with our so-called negative emotions. We try to reject them, we try to push them away because they're uncomfortable. And yet, what we see in psychological research, and that's very, very interesting, we see in psychological research is that when we shift from a space of go away to a space of it's okay that you're here, I recognize you, I respect you, I see you, you have a role in my psychological development, you have a role in my spiritual development, why are you here? When we move into that space of acceptance, something changes. Something crucial changes in our relationship with life. And the same happened in the movie Inside Out. It's only when the entire group of emotions accepted sadness that the child could move into the resolution of her challenge and difficulty.
Yes.
Actually, it was sadness that solved the difficulty. I think that's a very important point for us to consider. And why am I saying all that? Because I'm going back to the blog comment you've read a few minutes ago.
Yes.
When we go through that process that I've just described, this is when we can achieve what that person called faith, and I would refer to as trust. Because that's the first thing that is broken when we go through that crisis. Right? When we go through that experience of pain or sadness and all these negative emotions that flood us and they overwhelm us and they take over and we push them away, we feel so much frustration and so much anger and we lose faith in the world. We lose trust towards people. That's one of the first things that happened to us psychologically. Right? And being able to accept, realize, learn from what happened, and move on. And by the way, I just want to emphasize, the fact that we accept doesn't mean that we accept the person and what he did or what she did. So it's perfectly fine to say, he or she, they are not right for my life. I move away from them, right? So it's not about being passive. It's not about accepting everything anyone does to us.
Right.
It's just about accepting what's moving within us, you can take action, appropriate action that is right for you. But when we move into that space of acceptance within, then we can regain that experience of faith or trust in the world and in people around us. And that's a very important aspect of our healing here in life.
And you know, in my own life, when I have found myself feeling betrayed, what I have eventually learned is that the first break of trust is with myself, i.e., that is that I have not trusted myself that, say, there's something about this person that doesn't work for me, or I haven't trusted my reaction to the situation. And when I restore my trust in myself, then I don't have those experiences. Well, I hardly ever have them.
I love what you're saying. I love and I agree with every word you say. And I think for me, what it brings up is the relationship with my own internal voice, right? Do I have that kind of relationship? Because when I'm disconnected from that internal voice, or my intuition, or whatever we want to call it, this is when these things happen, right? This is when I will stay with a person who isn't right for me, although deep within there's this whisper saying, this isn't right, go away. But when we have the tools to reconnect with that which moves within us, then we can hear the whisper, and then we can take action, and then everything falls into place, and there's no need to get to the point where things break and we feel the pain, because we have acted upon it earlier because we heard within.
Right, right. I totally agree with you. That's a lovely way of putting it. And so what you've done now in your book is you've got 8 steps to help people develop their awareness, get back to who they really are. And we've talked about the first one, which is psychology and freedom. We've talked a bit about that. And we've talked a bit about meditation. You also have aware and unaware thinking, the illusion of the self, how everything is neutral. And impermanence is another one that I think you go into really nicely that is really hard for us. Can we look at impermanence for a moment, that nothing can be relied upon? That sort of fits in with what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely sort of almost an inevitable continuation of what we were talking about. I think impermanence is one of those really hard ones for all of us, because we tend, because the Buddha used to talk about the cycle of misery, which is very interesting. He used to say that we crave things that are going well and that we enjoy, so we try to hold them closely and we try to keep them in our lives as much as possible. And then there's the rejection aspect, so the opposite of craving, the rejection, and those are things we don't like and we try to push them away and don't come into my life and I don't want you. And what he says is that because of this very fundamental law of impermanence, no matter what you do, things you crave will go away, and things you reject will appear in your life. There's absolutely nothing we can do against that. We try to build some kind of safe and stable life to create the illusion that, you know, that which we want will stay and that which we don't want will never appear. But it's not going to happen. And this is where we need to embrace the idea of impermanence and the fact that whatever is now, it is now, and it means nothing about tomorrow. And it's a very difficult, from an emotional point of view, it's a very difficult one for us to accept, because, you know, it spans and touches upon every aspect of our lives. So, for example, I do a lot of work around meaning, right? So in positive psychology, which is the science of living life fully and utilizing aspects of life such as hope and gratitude and mindfulness. So as part of positive psychology, meaning is a very important psychological aspect. And the thing with meaning, and it's very interesting, the thing with meaning is that, you know, we go through a long journey of search, and we might find that which is very meaningful to us, and then we even apply it in our lives. So So, you know, you might even find a job that reflects your meaning, or you volunteer in something that reflects your meaning, or you invest time in your children if you find that this is something that is so meaningful to you at this point in life. And yet, meaning continuously changes because life changes, because we change, because everything is impermanent. And it's very difficult for us. I get a lot of clients coming in saying to me, I don't get it. I found this amazing thing. It was incredible for 1 year, 5 years, 20 years, 6 months, doesn't matter. And now it feels as if it's water dripping through my fingers and I can't hold it. And I can see in their eyes their frustration, and their frustration is based upon the fact that they refuse to accept this fundamental law of impermanence. Because everything changes, meaning will change as well. Another wonderful example is love, right? Our romantic relationships continuously change. Now, change doesn't mean that they need to end, but they do change. The nature of the relationship changes. The person with whom we are in a relationship changes. Everything keeps on moving. And yet when we start the relationship, our initial response to it is, this is how I want it. I want you to stay precisely like that. And then when it moves, we're frustrated, right? Because, again, we refuse to accept impermanence. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're bringing – my husband had cancer, and he's been ill over the last 4 years, and he died a month ago. And you're bringing to mind one of the things – now, he was a retired neurosurgeon, and he had been very successful in his life, but he really hated change. And it was such an interesting thing to be a part of, to watch him resist change when he was actually taking part in one of the biggest changes we experience here on the earth, that is of leaving the earth. And it was really, really difficult for him.
Yeah. Well, I can feel this is, you know, through your words, I can feel the struggle. And it's a very natural struggle. I have seen my own father die, and there was a lot of struggle there as well. It's a painful struggle, and I think perhaps it's the most extreme example, and the best example of how difficult for us it is to accept impermanence, because life is impermanent, not only in the fact that it changes, but also in the fact that it doesn't last forever, right? There's a change in the fact that it does end. And accepting the end of life it's powerful and profound and very difficult. And I think, you know, existential psychologists used to say something beautiful, and I want to share that with you and your listeners. They used to say that we're not really afraid of death as much as realizing at the last moments of our lives that we haven't really lived. Now,
No, I'm just reacting to that. Yes.
Yeah. How does it make you feel when I say that?
Well, it just brings up the many people that I've talked with, and you know, and I realized too that was part of my husband's struggle. Was he satisfied with the life he had lived? And he claimed that he was. He said that he was satisfied, although there were a few things he left undone, and probably there are a few for every one of us.
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. And I think that's a question that I'd like the listeners to ask themselves. You know, if I would die next month, this day, next month, 30 days from now, what would I need to do in these following 30 days in order for me to leave the world, to die peacefully? So going back to the point you were just making, you know, what things do we feel at this point are unresolved? And we tend to, because we don't accept impermanence, we don't really think about death. Death is something that most of us avoid and repress, as an idea, and that's why we don't really ask ourselves this question. But you know, there are really powerful interventions in psychology, in positive psychology, and interventions are exercises that we go through in order to achieve some kind of a psychological process. Wonderful interventions to do with death, to do with the engagement with death, to do with questions around my death, and what kind of legacy do I want to leave behind, and what kind of things do I need to do in order not to have regrets when I die. And it's not only in psychology, in spirituality, in Buddhism, there's a very popular meditation where you're being invited to imagine every morning a bird sitting on your shoulder, whispering in your ear, what if that was the last day of your life? And to contemplate that, not only on a cognitive level, but also deep within, what emotions does it trigger? The possibility that this is my last day. And it could be my last day, because no one knows. I might go out to buy an ice cream and get hit by a car, and this will be my last day, right? So what do I feel when the idea that this is my last day is being contemplated? And you see, I think this is a really powerful meditation, sitting, breathing, asking myself the question, what if this is my last day upon earth, and seeing what is being triggered inside. And for a lot of us, there's anxiety. And the anxiety is linked with these questions or with these comments we've made earlier about what have I left undone?
Yeah. And it strikes me, I'm now 73 years old, and somebody who was on this program said that I'll be living to 105. And I'm healthy okay. now, and I'm strong. Well, I don't know, you know, I can't say for sure. But if I were to live, say, another 30 years, how would I do it so that I don't spend most of my time snoozing in a corner, which is not the way I'd like to spend my time? And what I realized is that I need to continue to engage life in the same way that I was doing when I was 30. Something comes up, I say, yes, that's something that interests me. I'll investigate it. I'll take part in it. And I think that's one of the things that's very hard for us as human beings to, and I found this true with my husband, because I knew that he was inevitably going to die, is how do you stay in the present moment and live your life fully at the same time you're aware that you're not going to always have a life here, and that there is something more to you than just, you know, eating your Wheaties in the morning for breakfast.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a really powerful question. And by the way, the beauty of the question is that it applies to all of us. So your husband found that he has cancer, and therefore that understanding became very clear and almost inevitable. But it applies to me and you and anyone else who's listening to us, because we don't know when it's going to happen, and it could be very soon. But I think that the difference is that your husband was almost, the realization was almost forced upon him,
yes,
in a way that he couldn't avoid. In a way that he couldn't avoid. And for most of us, as long as we don't get this kind of news, we avoid that question until it is inevitable. So I think what I'm trying to ask is what would happen to us if we wouldn't avoid it, if we would recognize that it could happen tomorrow? And hopefully for everyone who's listening to us and to the both of us, it'll happen many, many years from now. But what if it does happen in a few weeks' time? And these are questions that we show in psychological research, questions that are very important to our well-being, because when we move from back to the original topic, it happens because the recognition of impermanence becomes experiential, not just as an idea in our heads, but something within us. It's as if something drops and goes, okay, and the body can relax. I'm not in a state of anxiety of it anymore. I'm in a state of acceptance. But that requires work.
Isn't that... aren't you also describing a way to get underneath ego concepts and into the more transcendent state, which is to not just lock in to what is here on the earth, but to see that there's here and there's not here? One of the people on a chat here says that coping with these questions is where psychology and spirituality really come together.
I completely agree. I completely agree. Absolutely, yes. I think there's something profoundly spiritual in the realization that we will not live forever, and the existential crisis and the fear of death. When we go through them and we go through the transformation and we move into acceptance, I feel that we then experience something that is deeply spiritual, and we move into that state of transcendence. And I also agree with the original point you were just saying about the ego concept, because let's think about it. Where does it all begin? Where does it begin? Where the idea that I need to stay here for as long as possible, and I want things to stay precisely as they are, and I want nothing to change, and I want people around me to stay as they are. Where does it begin? It begins in our ego concepts, right? It begins
yes.
with the understandings we created within ourselves about the world. The world should be this, and people should be that, and that shouldn't move or change, because if it does change, then it scares me. It throws me out of my comfort zone. I don't like that. These are all ego concepts.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So yes, absolutely. The person who wrote what they wrote on the chat, you know, he or she, they're spot on. That's exactly the point where psychology and spirituality come together, because that's when we recognize these ego concepts. We understand where the fear of transcendence, the fear of impermanence, come from, and we are then able to move deeper into transcendence.
Yes, yes, and what an interesting thing that is to be doing that consciously, which is, as I'm reading your book, Awareness is Freedom, that's what you're helping your reader to do, is to do that consciously. And I, you know, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop here, but I just want to point out that you have exercises in your book that allow people to do here and now things like identifying what ego concepts they may be carrying, and you have a listing of a whole lot of different kinds of meditations, and you have also exercises that people can do for a week, 8 of them, maybe more than 8, because I know you have one or two chapters that have more than one, but and you also have scales where people can see where they stand in terms of being able to handle impermanence or some of the things that you've been talking about today. So it's a very full book, and Paul, get a copy of your book, Itai.
This unknown website called Amazon. if they go to Amazon, or they go to any, if they just put into Google Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality, the book is being sold in every online bookstore. Obviously, easy to find in any of them. So I think it's not difficult. And thank you for the description. I think it was a very good description of the different aspects of the book. And the one of the main reasons for the fact that I love the book is that it's not just theory. I don't believe in pure theory. I believe that we need to understand certain concepts, but then we have to experience these concepts. So the book is filled with exercises.
Yes, and it's through that experience that we will have the kind of understanding you've been discussing today. Well, I'm even more convinced than I was before reading your book and talking with you that psychology and spirituality do dovetail beautifully, and in fact, we need both of them as we work with ourselves and move toward transcendence, which we all are doing more and more right now. And I know that it's very powerful, and it allows for incredible change and growth, which might be scary to some, but once you get on the growth trail, it's not so scary. So I wonder.
That's precisely so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel maybe my sort of final words. This journey, this trail you were talking about, it's scary, and it's it feels as if it's, as I said earlier, it throws us out of our comfort zone, and it feels like the unknown. Out of my personal experience and the experience of groups that I've worked with and clients that I've worked with, it's extremely rewarding. Seeing yourself transforming is an incredible gift that makes us feel proud of ourselves and makes us feel self-actualized.
Yes, that's a wonderful way of saying that. So let me remind people that your website is Awareness is Freedom. And Dr. Itzvan, thank you so much for being my guest here today on Full Power Living. It's been a pleasure.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you, Eileen.
So join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m., which is noon Eastern time, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. And remember, next week, next Thursday, grief recovery expert Russell Friedman will return to Full Power Living to talk with me about grief recovery for children. Paul Johnson of Fresh Talk Media is our producer. Thank you, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.